Blog Talk Radio. The following program is brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE.
Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence.
Welcome to the Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable. I'm John Carosella, together with my co-hosts, Deb Carosella.
Good morning.
Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Good morning, John.
And Heisi Lutmers.
Hello.
So for today's roundtable, well, it's May. We're in the sweet spot of spring heading into summer, and the life of the planet, the garden aspect of the planet is very prominent in my thinking and in my feeling. So the question that I have for my co-hosts and our listeners is, what's in your garden? What have you planted, and how is it emerging, and how is it being nurtured by you? How's the garden going? Right? Are you having success with the things that you've planted? And are there things emerging in your garden that you realize, whoops, maybe I didn't really want to plant that. Maybe I didn't have room for that. Maybe that needs to be thinned. these are garden metaphors, and I do mean to talk about the physical world around us, the literally the gardening that we're doing, because it's a reflection of our interests and our passions, but also energetically, and our walk in the world. What have we been sowing, and how's that crop looking to us right about now? So anybody care to kick in a thought or two?
Sure, I'd be happy to, John. It's Mildred Lynn. So what have I planted? Well, over the last little while, we've changed geographic locations and basically left into the unknown. We had a few variables that presented themselves that we had to set our compass by, but the rest of it was, by gosh and by golly, let's hold our breath and take the dive. And we landed in a very fertile spot. Ideas and possibilities and opportunities all seem to manifest out of nowhere. And as I look at the garden that we were courageous enough to plant over the last couple of months, I see lots of colors and lots of shapes and magic and a sense of wonder. So in my garden personally, it's almost as if there's a great big exhale, and when I inhale, it's all the colors and fragrances and lusciousness of nature.
So your exhale was the willingness to leave the old garden, so to speak.
Exactly, and it too was a lovely garden. So that was a little bit difficult to leave.
Yeah, that's interesting. So saying goodbye to something that you were comfortable with and loved, and yet, and not knowing the soil in which you were about to plant your new seeds.
Exactly. So it was a you know, at times it was a scary journey, at times it was a very sad journey, and I went through a long grieving period. But as I sit here and reflect back, and if any of our listeners are in a similar situation and they feel that they have a strong sense that they need to move forward into another garden, I would highly encourage them to do that.
That's great. And is there anything in that new garden that needs a little bit more tending, or maybe needs to be thinned or weeded?
No.
You're an expert gardener. Okay, sure. Uh-huh. You're the kind of gardener that no one else likes to have around.
Well, I have to be honest.
Of course.
It might be different next week, right? Right now, garden is in full bloom.
Oh, that's beautiful. And do you anticipate planting more, or is the garden at capacity right now?
I believe it's at capacity.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to know, too. When you've laid down the seeds and you've set up the garden the way you think you like it, and, you know, sometimes you don't, you know, that's all there is to it, right? The garden is there to be enjoyed, and Mother Nature does its work.
Yeah, and I think it's also... sometimes when we have a list or we have to rally to get to the next spot we're going to, sometimes there's a tendency to just keep going with your list.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to share with our listeners is that if you give yourself the opportunity to sit back and enjoy your garden, it's so fulfilling and it's so nurturing. And actually, you forget about your list.
Yeah, that's great. To enjoy your garden, enjoy the fruits and the blossoms. That's a good idea. Cool. Thanks, Mildred Lynn. How about you, Deb? What do you got going?
Well, I find that we're moving into the area that Mildred has just started to move out of. We are also facing a period of adjustment, a period of change, where the garden that we have lived in for quite a while now is we're about to make a move from that and go leap into the unknown. And it's a very frightening, scary, kind of sad place to be in. But it also, it's taken me some time to get to a point where I can find a sense of excitement about the possibility of the unknown.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of an interesting and very welcome place to be right now. But what I have noticed is that I have started to pay a lot of attention to the environment that we are living in.
Yeah. Yeah, you talked earlier about pictures.
I've been taking a lot of pictures. It's sort of the things that will be left behind.
Yeah, like our cherry tree.
Yeah.
And the roses.
That you know, leads to a lot of melancholy, a lot of grieving. But there's also the joy that all of those things have brought over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I've noticed that in a lot of ways, what we have here and what just recently I became aware that many of the things that physically are planted or are plants that we have in our home are also things that I remember from my childhood.
Mm.
And it just suddenly dawned on me that, my gosh, my grandmother would be very comfortable here because these are the plants my grandmother had in her yard.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an interesting revelation. It was kind of an interesting feeling. And it was nice to have that connection, that tie.
Yeah.
And so as we move into the new place, the new space, whatever it may be, wherever it may be, some of that can come with me. I can replant that. But I can also plant or find something brand new there too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So the continuity, the interesting thing to note is the connection with your ancestral heritage in a way.
Right.
That has come into your awareness. So some of those things we may have been cultivating for a while, but suddenly you're aware that that's a connection. So in a way, what's blooming in your garden is a connection to your ancestral line.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Cool. Anything that needs to be weeded?
Oh, there are thousands of things that need to be weeded in our yard.
okay, not just the yard, okay?
Things that... probably, metaphorically speaking, I'm sure that as I approach this and as I'm living through this and coming to grips with this, I am finding things that can be let go of or can be, it's not so much let go of, but you come to terms with the letting go.
Mm. Yeah, that served its purpose. It's done its thing. And it is better to make room for something else.
Sometimes it doesn't. Okay, I'm not sure that I'm 100% ready to sign on to the "it's better to make room for something else" place yet. I'm still at the "it will be okay to make room for something else." It's not better.
Yeah,
it's just I'm moving into the "it will be okay."
Right, right. So less panic, more co-creation.
Right, and beginning to build a sense of anticipatory excitement.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Hi, C, how about you? What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I have to say that, you know, I don't have a green thumb. I don't even have a brown thumb. I think I have a black hole thumb. but I did try planting some things last year in our yard, and it's hard because we have very clay-like soil, so it's not very conducive to things. And and somebody also introduced me to the wonders of watering. Apparently, if you water things, they are. but now I'm starting to see a lot of the things that I planted last year kind of taking off, I guess.
Yeah.
And they seem
to
kind of sit there, but now it seems as if with spring and everything, they've started to, I really notice the difference of how they start filling out or getting bigger and all that kind of stuff. And it made me start to think that what can be more important right now, if I think energetically of a garden, is because what I did is I focused on getting more native plants and some drought tolerant plants, probably more so that they'll tolerate me and my watering schedule. but, you know, energetically, that seems to say to me, if we right now focus more on what it is that we have to work with, kind of like what Milda was talking about, appreciating what you have in your garden. It's seeing what you already have to work with and finding ways to work with. So you also become much more attuned to working with both the things and the quantities and proportions that you have in ways that are most conducive. And then, you know, and also like the drought tolerant aspect makes me think of learning how to adapt to the conditions and work with the conditions rather than focusing on how we wish conditions were different, because then we're never really focusing on getting a lot of things done versus always focusing on what we wish we could do if things were different, you know. And so being more willing to focus on what is and adapt to how to work with that.
So kind of like thriving in the present moment. Thriving with the present moment.
Right. And also understanding that it takes a little bit of time, just like the plants I put in last year. Now I'm actually seeing growth or change in them. Whereas if I went out a month after I planted them thinking, well, how come they're not growing? you know, it's because we expect that instant gratification.
Yeah. Natural cycles require a little bit of patience. They really do.
And what Deb was talking about in terms of noticing more like plants that she had when she was a child and, you know, in her yard now and that kind of thing also makes me think of recommending to people, if you're unsure of what it is you might need to be planting or cultivating or weeding or harvesting right now, pay attention to what catches your eye. So if we want to use the plant analogy, if you go out for a walk, pay attention if a particular flower catches your eye or a particular tree catches your eye, and then research what the spirit medicine or the energy is around that particular flower or plant or tree, because that will then give you either something that you may need medicinally in your life, or energetically it may help to indicate a message or something that you may be needing or pointing you in the direction of what you need to be cultivating or weeding at this particular moment. And that's why those particular plants would catch your eye.
Yeah, and you know, saying an energetic hello to those plants can often elicit a response that is quite enlightening. You know, they can share with you a message about what they're doing that's making them happy that might might trigger something in you. So any weeding that you need to be doing or that you're sensing needs to be done?
Well, good heavens, no.
No, of course not. Okay, so I'll have to share with you all. I mean, I'm such an enthusiastic gardener that I love to plant. I plant lots and lots of things, and usually I overplant. And you know, my challenge has been to regulate my impulse to cultivate a lot of soil very densely, and then I am so resistant to thinning. You know, I plant all this lettuce and like every little, you know, every square inch pops up, a little lettuce pops up and I'm like, I can't pull that out. That could be food later. So I think what I'm learning in this season is a little bit more throttle control. You know, I'm sensing that I'm in a lot of cases, I'm over committed and overly busy, and that I have to be ready to weed. I have to be ready to say, you know, that was a cool idea. We tried it. It's either not working, it's not growing, it's not thriving, or I don't have time to cultivate it enough to empower it to thrive, or there's just too much of it and it'll be fine, but I just need to do less of it. And that's true. That's true in the garden and in my life right now. That's just the flush of the germination and new growth is present, and I need to think about and look into thinning, you know, pruning, thinning, weeding, and really focusing on the things that are gonna bear, that are gonna produce the harvest that I really want, because we do live in a garden, and there's lots to harvest. But you got to be able to tend to you have to be able to tend to it in order for it to be healthy. So that's where I am.
Yeah, and the other thing, John, too, that I found really useful is watching plants grow introduces you to nature's heartbeat and growth yes. cycle, and it really slows you down.
Yes.
To the healthy heartbeat, your internal one.
Yeah, I agree. It's almost blissful in its tranquility and its gentleness.
And I have a weird thing about weeds, because I don't see any plant as bad. Because I always pay attention. If it pops up unexpectedly in my yard, I want to know what it is, and then I'll look up and see what that is about energetically, because it will show up for a reason. And it's always hard for me to figure out how to deal with weeds, because it's like with dandelions. Dandelions are so amazingly healthy, and yet everybody, you know, freaks out when they show up in their yard. And I don't care, because I'd rather have a relationship with the dandelion than go out there and try to pull it out just to have a perfectly manicured lawn.
Well, you know, my thought on weeds is that there are no weeds. There are only success stories. And we get, you know, we, in a sense, we get what we cultivate, and nature abhors a vacuum. So spaces get filled in. If we don't intentionally create in a space, then somebody else is going to create in that space for us. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining me on today's roundtable. We'll be back after a short break with the rest of the show. Please join us and stay tuned. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
As promised, we're always thinking of ways to bring you a fresh new perspective. Check out this lineup of our newest shows. The Amethyst Oracle, divination with a queer twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella, on the first and third Tuesday evenings each month. The brand new Embracing Change, The Joy of a New Path, with career coach Ivan Teams and John Carosella, the fourth Tuesday evening of each month. What's Your Prescription for Balance? With Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday afternoon each month. And Evolve, with Robin White Turtle Lisney, the third Thursday afternoon each month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella. In today's Exploring Reality segment, I want to share with you some insights I discovered about pollen and the nature of allergies. There is a lot of pollen out this month. May is a beautiful month. It's always a trigger time for me, though. I love the beauty of the landscape and the delightful breezes and gentle sunshine. But there's a period of about 2 weeks when something is blooming that has a very powerful effect on me. This year was no different. I was off doing my happy outdoor thing, and suddenly it hit me. That feeling of a slowly growing but overwhelming wave that is about to swamp me. Sometimes I can feel it coming from a long way off, if I'm paying attention. Sometimes it pounces into my awareness suddenly, and then I realize, I'd sensed it coming all along. It's like a tsunami. A really wide, really deep, really heavy wave that flows into me and just stays. My eyes itch like crazy. I can't stop rubbing them. Of course, that only makes it worse. And my nose runs and I sneeze constantly. I pretty much refuse to take any pharmaceuticals, so over-the-counter allergy medicine is out of the question. I've taken it before, and it either makes me dopey drowsy or it makes it impossible for me to sleep. So I just don't do it. But the allergy experience itself is so uncomfortable for me. It saps my energy and it makes it hard for me to get anything done. Since last year, though, I've had a different perspective on this allergy, and I've been able to take a different approach in dealing with it. Last May, as I was sitting there suffering one day, trying to fight off the itchy eyes and sneezy nose in hopes of being productive, my friend and colleague Suzette Marie said, "Maybe it's not an allergy. Maybe it's medicine for you. Maybe it's helping you to release something." Well, that sounded like an interesting perspective. I was totally game for turning something very annoying, indeed debilitating, into something good for me, if only I could pull it off. So I started doing some investigating. I did a little homework on what pollen does in a plant. When pollen reaches the stigma, the most central structure at the heart of a flower, it sticks, and then it starts dissolving the material beneath it until it tunnels its way down from the surface into the womb of the plant. That's where the male DNA coating in the pollen then fertilizes the female egg and stimulates the fruiting process. Okay, so there's a kind of active principle inherent in the pollen and a receptive principle for the stigma. But what does that have to do with humans and with me and with my allergic reaction? I did some more homework on what an allergic reaction actually is. What is it that pollen does in a human? I had long understood that it creates something called a histamine reaction, but I never really understood what that was all about. What were histamines, and why did we have them? It turns out that histamines play lots of different roles in the body. They are active in the brain as neurotransmitters, and they help us regulate our wakefulness and sleep. They're in our gut and play a role in digestion. And the histamine reaction, that thing that happens when we have an allergy attack, That's histamines dilating blood vessels and making the vessel walls extra permeable. So then, I examined what I was experiencing. Of course, on the surface of my awareness, it was the histamine reaction, the symptoms of the allergy, the runny nose, itchy, watery eyes, and swollen sinuses. But where in all of that, I asked, was I? Or to put it another way, what were all those symptoms connected to deep within me? Where did all that discomfort come together? In other words, where did it hurt? And what if it was medicine? Suzette said, it's helping you to release. To figure this part out, I sat quietly and closed my eyes. I calmed myself enough to begin to notice the subtle things, the non-tangible things that were happening inside me. The most significant thing I noticed right away was my fierce resistance. Resistance to what? Well, to the feeling of swelling in my eyes, nose, and sinuses. I was fighting hard against it. I took the time to feel my way through and into that resistance. I let go of sensing the itch and embraced sensing the resistance. This next part is hard to describe, but I think it's useful for me to try. It was as if someone was blasting away with a weapon of light and heat, to the area all around my head. And all that light and heat was making the area around my head hot and full of a kind of fiery plasma that was stuck in that area, almost like this weapon was firing into a heat shield that was between me and the rest of the world. Now, I can't tell whether I was the one blasting away or I was the one holding the heat shield in place, or both. I just know that I was in the middle of it, and it was not a happy or productive scene. Once I got a handle on the dimensions and depth of the resistance, I began to try to release it, to let go. The first phase of that process was to stop seeing the situation as an antagonism. The pollen, the reaction, the motion of it all, I said to myself, was appropriate. It was an okay thing, a good thing, nothing to fight. Rather, it was a release of something. What? I didn't know. The second phase was to drop the shield, to let down my guard and allow what was happening to happen. What I found was that if I was very still and did not try to do anything else but allow, the feeling of discomfort and resistance transformed into a feeling of quiescence and permeability through which something was being released from me out into the ether. I could literally feel it passing out of me. What was this something? I'm not sure I totally know, but here's a clue. The stillness that I had to adopt was a meditation of sorts. It required me to be completely present to myself and the moment. I could not read. I could not write. I could not plan or think or be in the future or the past. Fretting about my to-do list only made it worse. I had to be fully present. What I felt dissipating through this process was the compelling urge to be doing. All the items on my to-do list, my sense of having or wanting to engage with the world and experience something resulting from the application of my force of my will onto the world, had to go. Instead, I had to be completely receptive and, I guess, in a way, vulnerable. What evaporated out of me was attachment, desire, action, and drive. What was revealed in its wake, in its absence,
was clarity. How odd that a hay fever reaction could lead to clarity. They say that allergic reactions are more pronounced in those that lead an unhealthy lifestyle, smoking, bad diet, etc., and also in those that lead a hypersanitary lifestyle, everything sprayed with disinfectants and very restricted encounters with the dirt of the natural world. I think if a histamine reaction makes one more permeable, and an unhealthy or hypersanitary lifestyle exacerbates the reaction, then perhaps what pollen is doing is offering us the opportunity to reconnect with the energies of the natural world and cleanse ourselves of those things in our lives that are impediments to doing so. Bee pollen is known in naturopathic circles as very strong medicine. It's even good for allergies. Maybe taking bee pollen as part of our diet keeps the flow going, starting from the inside, so that we're just inherently more permeable and connected to the energies of the natural world. Perhaps the bees and the flowers have something to teach us about the healing power that comes from intimacy with the natural environment. And while any time of the year is a good one to stop doing and allow yourself to be in communion with nature, May is a good time for such a potent reminder. Surprising medicine, that pollen. Good medicine. We'll be right back.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is proud to support Bright Haven, a non-profit holistic animal retreat founded in the early 1990s by Richard and Gail Pope to provide sanctuary to animals in need of specialized treatment and elderly care. Bright Haven also acts as an education center for the community, sharing knowledge of holistic healing for animals. In 2010, Bright Haven expanded into the world of animal shelter rescue with Bright Haven Rescue Operations, placing animals at risk for euthanasia into foster and forever homes. Discover more information and how to donate at brighthaven.org. This tip of the week from the Bright Haven Education Program. Before taking your pet to the vet for their annual vaccine, stop and consider if this is really needed. Most vaccines do not need to be repeated annually. We humans do not vaccinate ourselves annually through life, do we? After the initial vaccinations, it may be that immunity to the disease has been established. Did you know there are titer tests available to check on immunity? One can become better informed simply by reading some of the valuable information available on the internet.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. And with me for today's spirited conversation is a friend and colleague of mine, John Montgomery. John is an entrepreneur, corporate and executive coach, corporate attorney, and author of Great from the Start, a step-by-step guide to building a successful conscious corporation. John is the founder of the law firm Montgomery & Hanson. He is also the founder of Startworks, a Silicon Valley-based technology incubator that develops startups to thrive in an interdependent global economy. He was also a co-chair of the legal working group behind California's new benefit corporation legislation. John is currently co-founding an international management consultancy to empower established European and American businesses to become iconic representatives of the emerging sustainable global economic system. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, it really is. It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to have you on the show. Convergence is a show that brings together the scientific and the mystical. And it may seem odd to our listeners that a high-powered Silicon Valley lawyer is on the show today. But the work that you are doing, the attention you are paying to birthing a new way of doing business and cultivating the people and the talent that is required to do business in that way and creating the structures, that's really magical stuff. It's what I would refer to as a very deep kind of power. And I'm excited to have you share your perspective on that and why, how you found yourself in this place. because I think this is really, really powerful and important for not just for our listeners, but for us systemically overall.
Well, let me give you a little bit of background, John, as to how I came into this curious place of magic and as you intimated, alchemical power. I am the son of an entrepreneur. My father built a Fortune 500 company from scratch. He was one of the first, his company, Cooper Laboratories, is one of the first companies to get venture capital from the American Research and Development Company in the early 60s. And so I grew up in an entrepreneurial household. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I was a studio art major and minored in creative writing. And long story short, didn't get into the MFA programs that I applied to and got into the one law school that I applied to and ended up, you know, getting my law degree quite reluctantly. And what I gravitated towards was the creative process, because that's what I was trained in my undergraduate education, was being comfortable in the field of infinite possibilities. Because if you're writing fiction or creating a painting, you basically start with a blank piece of paper or a blank canvas and learn how to translate your ideas and thoughts and emotions into something tangible. And through serendipity and following my intuition, I ended up working with entrepreneurs and discovered that basically we're working with the same creative processes that I played around with in my undergraduate education, except we're doing it with people. And entrepreneurs start with an idea and they attract people around it, and they essentially design and invent living organisms. And what I observed from having represented somewhere over 500 startups over the course of my career is that each startup company is a unique collective social organism. And one of the things about my work that I'm trying to bring to light is that through the social neurons in our brains and our evolutionary biology, every time we humans get together in a group, we form a tribe. And those tribes are very powerful. You know, from an evolutionary standpoint, we're hardwired to join and form groups to self-preservation. And this is part of the magic alchemy of corporations, is that every time entrepreneurs gather and assemble a company, they're actually triggering millions and millions of years of complex evolutionary neurology in our brains and are creating, you know, living social organisms. And part of what I'm trying to do is make that process object and visible so that we can actually start consciously designing our corporations and other social collectives in a way that they're optimized and engineered for the human beings that actually have to work in them.
And for the planet that has to support them and sustain them.
Absolutely, because our lack of awareness that we're creating these collective life forms means that the collective life forms have relatively low consciousness and self-awareness.
Right.
And as a result, we've created a global economic system that, and this may be a little bit harsh, is populated by corporate entities that are generally lobotomized because they don't contain any legal or social architecture to really support anything other than a very, very rudimentary and simple pecuniary conscience and consciousness, as reflected in the maxim that corporations exist solely to maximize profit for shareholders.
Yeah, so this is, I think, important for us to tease out. So the two things that I want to dig into a little bit. One is that we form a tribe when we gather and make a corporate body, right?
Right.
And the DNA, the lessons that are, the intelligence that's embedded in our DNA, that makes tribal behavior viable and successful relates to a very ancient kind of interaction with our environment, right? So it's like we learned tribal behavior when we were when the world was a very different place.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now there are some aspects of that are cooperative and reflect an intimacy with our environment, because tribal cultures emerged living in very close harmony with their environment. And there's part of that DNA, there's part of that intelligence that relates to protection and exclusion, or self-interests, right? Like survival self-interest, which isn't necessarily harmonious with other living entities in the environment.
Right.
So we're battling. So there's two sides to the tribal coin, to that tribal intelligence that we bring to bear as we create corporations. And the other thing that I wanted to tease out was, the less consciously we recognize the nature of a corporation as a living thing, the less conscious the corporation is as a living thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so the first step in this is recognizing that the corporation is a living thing, and to bring in some of the emerging neuroscience and psychology about tribes and about, for example, the mirror neurons that we have in our brains.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, the preliminary research is showing that we have cells that are called mirror neurons in our brains, and they are largely part of the autonomous nervous system. IBM will tell you that our brains process about 20 million bits of data every second. And the vast majority of those bits of data that are getting processed are being processed subconsciously. And in part of the subconscious processing system are a lot of our social neurons and the information that they process. So for example, every time we are in a group, our mirror neurons will automatically scan the group to determine who the leader is. And to maximize the efficiency of group behavior, the mirror neurons automatically pick up social cues, cues about expected behaviors, values, and even the mood and level of consciousness of the leader. And the folks that have chosen a particular tribe will automatically, through these automatic processes, align themselves and their state of consciousness and their state of being to that of the leader. And most of the time, these processes occur subconsciously without any of us being aware of it. And that's one determinant of collective behavior. And then we have, the legal system, which codifies the legal structure of a corporation and what its some of its rules of behavior vis-a-vis society. And, in our Anglo-Saxon derived system, it's generally believed that corporations exist solely to optimize profit for shareholders, which is a very primitive form of social conscience that leaves the weighing of consequences of collective behavior on society and the environment up to people outside of the corporation.
So let's talk a little bit about that. We've talked about this in the past in personal conversations. The DNA of the American corporation, where did that come from?
Well, I mean, basically the entire global economic system, it shares a corporate form that has similar DNA that basically has not evolved very far from the original corporations that were generally chartered by kings in Europe as agents of exploration. The example I like to use is the Hudson's Bay Company, which was chartered by, I think it was King James of England, and gave the Hudson's Bay Company a charter and monopoly to exploit the Hudson's Bay watershed. And that corporation was designed to expand the territory of empire and find additional sources of revenue for the royal treasury. So the corporation helped England conquer North America and claim its territory and gave a share of its profits to the treasury. And the last thing that the King of England wanted to do was create a rival economic or political power. So basically, the corporation was on a relatively short leash. And if the Hudson's Bay Company misbehaved, the king could revoke the charter, you know, give it to somebody else, call the leaders back to London, put them in the tower or whatever. And when Europe got rid of its kings, the basic corporate form that really didn't have any internal legal architecture other than a primitive military chain of command system carried forward. And the external conscience function, although that for protecting the interests of society that was served just by the king, got passed to legislative bodies. And that was true in the colonies. When America became a republic, there were about 50 corporations. And the legislature served the function of being of society's external conscience. And that all changed in 1811 when New York adopted free incorporation and limited liability, which inventions spread around the planet like a happy virus over the next 50 years. And the net result of this system is that anywhere on the globe, any human being that can fog a mirror can go get, you know, incorporate a corporation. And that corporation has infinite life, and there's very little check and balance by society on that corporation's behavior. And there's no real internal social conscience in the corporation. The external social conscience served by the king and then the legislature pretty much vanished.
Now, so why did it – we still have legislative authority. We still have the bias of democratic governments to govern themselves and to govern the behavior of the systems that are part of their culture. Why are corporations so immune to that function?
Well, part of it is a function of the form that's evolved. I mean, we so take for granted the current corporate architecture that we've lost sight of where it came from. And you know, one of the things that came up with Occupy and the 99% is that there's a hint of the people remembering that, you know, we the people, when America was founded, never got to answer the fundamental philosophical question of what should the rights and moral responsibilities of our corporate citizens be. And because we the people have never answered that fundamental philosophical question, whenever philosophical questions come up, they either get answered by the legislature or by the Supreme Court. And part of what Occupy and the 99% are hinting at is that, you know, we the people are waking up and remembering that the ultimate sovereignty for corporations rests with the people. Because right now in all the 50 states, when you charter a corporation, you go to the Secretary of State and it's just like getting a rubber stamp. You get your articles filed and you're done and you've got a legal entity. Mm-hmm. And the you know, the Secretary of State is a public servant who serves whom? We the people. So part of what I think is happening is that, you know, we are waking up and remembering that we never really answered the fundamental philosophical question. We've got these large collective life forms that have a lot more power than an individual citizen. And one would think that a social collective that has more power would be, held to at least as high a social standard as individual humans are.
right?
If not higher, because the potential for harm is that much greater.
And yet they're not. And in fact, they're structurally designed around this fiduciary function, which came out of some other precedent.
Yeah, that came out in the 1800s, you know, largely as a response to, you know, limited liability and situations where, you know, management of corporations would, exploit the assets of the corporation, not for the shareholders, but for management. And so the courts imposed some of the fiduciary duties from trusts and estates onto directors of corporations as kind of a remedy for, you know, abuses of power. And that was kind of the history of it. So, you know, one of the things I've thought would be really fun would be, you know, if we could hold a constitutional convention in, you know, 2014 and have the rights and responsibilities of our collective citizens, i.e. corporations and other collective entities, as one of the, you know, agenda items, it would be a fascinating exercise.
Yeah, well, I mean, with the transcendent problem with corporations is that they don't have a natural death. They can have circumstantial death, right? They can go bankrupt and whatnot, but they don't have an intrinsic time limit on them.
Right, and so theoretically they have the power of immortality, and you know that's a tremendous power. You know, we have instances of companies like Procter & Gamble that are almost 200 years old. And, you know, I think the oldest corporation around is one in Sweden. It's a mining company that's over 700 years old. So, you know, they have the power of immortality, which, you know, can be abused. And, you know, we really have never squarely addressed, you know, sort of a code of conduct, a minimum code of conduct or a minimum universal set of values or morality for, you know, our corporate collectives.
So, you know, I've had this conversation with some other folks. Do we need that? Could it not be the case that it's just incumbent upon the society as a whole or the operators of the corporations to become awakened and conscious so that they don't behave in that way, so that they're prevented from behaving in ways that are fundamentally negligent or abusive?
Well, I think, you know, consciousness is something that evolves on many levels. There's individual consciousness and there's collective consciousness. And I think we're in a part of history where consciousness has the potential of taking, you know, great leaps forward. And on our collective level, there's just developing the awareness that when we create corporations or other business entities, we're actually creating, you know, living social organisms. And those social organisms, just like individuals, can have very low levels of consciousness or they can have very high levels of consciousness. And the interesting thing that's emerging is there's a direct correlation between the level of consciousness of the leader of a tribe or a corporation and the collective level of consciousness of that entity. And so I think what we're going to see emerging over the next decades is that, you know, business schools and law schools and other professional programs are increasingly going to become multidisciplinary, and consciousness and its cultivation, you know, as expressed in various spiritual traditions and in, you know, developmental theories like, you know, spiral dynamics or integral theory, are going to become much more of the vernacular and mainstream vocabulary, because, you know, it's all about optimal performance. And what I think is beginning to emerge is that there's a correlation not between success but probability of success with the level of consciousness of the leader. and the entity. And the higher, the more, you know, and just to give people a little bit of a framework, you know, this is a very simple framework, but consciousness generally tends to evolve from being egocentric to other-centric to we-centric to planetary-centric. And its center of gravity or locus in a being or entity tends to go from the head to the heart. And, you know, that's the, you know, that's kind of a crass overview of how consciousness evolves. And corporations generally, because they're focused solely on maximizing profit, tend to be collectively egocentric. They're focused on maximizing profit without really paying much attention to the consequences of corporate behavior on society and the environment. And what's exciting is that there are new ways of business emerging, conscious capitalism being one, benefit corporations being another, where corporations not only optimize profit for shareholders, but provide a material positive impact on society and the environment while they're doing it. And the preliminary economic data shows that corporations that are organized in this way actually provide a better return for their shareholders.
Hmm. So why don't we take a short break? And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about these other models of corporate structure and why we're seeing the return on investment of those kinds of corporations seems to be exceeding that of the old style. So
great.
We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Yes, we've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows, but don't forget our original Sunday morning lineup at 10:30 a.m. Join us for Healing Conversations with Mildred Lynn McDonald every first Sunday. Revolution with Heisey Ludmers every second Sunday. Convergence with John Carosella every third Sunday. And our popular on-air call-in show, the fourth Sunday of every month. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows, LIVE.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella. With me today is John Montgomery, author of Great from the Start and co-facilitator and co-birther of the Conscious Benefit Corporation legislation in California. We're talking about corporations, the future of corporations, and the role that they play in our culture. And before the break, John, you were talking about the emergence of consciousness in the corporation. And that there are ways of cultivating a different kind of consciousness in the corporation. Tell us a little bit about the California Benefits Corporation and conscious capitalism as alternatives to the status quo.
Sure. Well, let's start with the benefit corporation legislation. There are 12 states, including California and New York, that have adopted what's known as benefit corporation legislation. And a benefit corporation is generally identical to a state's existing corporate entity with three very simple exceptions. And the first is that a benefit corporation must provide a material positive impact on society and the environment from its operations taken as a whole. And that impact must be measured against a third-party standard and reported annually to its shareholders and the public. Mm. So there's accountability, transparency, and public benefit.
And that's whether you're a public company or not, that it has to be reported publicly?
That's whether you're a public company or not.
That's awesome.
And so what we basically did with the legislation was we created a voluntary opt-in section of the corporate code that allows entrepreneurs who are socially responsible to elect to create an entity that has a inherent value system that's in alignment with their own. In other words, a benefit corporation has a triple bottom line orientation in that It optimizes profit for shareholders, and it looks out for people, i.e. its positive impact on society, and it looks after the planet, i.e. its effect on the environment.
And that's it, you know, it's kind of stunning that that is a new invention.
Well, it is. We, you know, in the legislative process, we got a lot of comments from people. They said, well, I mean, duh, why isn't every corporation doing it this way? I mean, why shouldn't we require every corporation to do things this way? Well, and I think that's where we will end up in, 20 or 30 years. But for now, in order to get benefit corporation passed, we had to make it simple and voluntary. And because there's any time human beings have to change on a subconscious level in our brains, it triggers a fight or flight response, which produces cortisol and adrenaline, which creates resistance to change. And so what we tried to do with benefit corporation legislation was design the legislation so that it's as simple as possible. There's basically one sentence, the one that requires the corporation to provide a material positive impact on society and the environment, that literally changes the expression of the corporate animal, right? Just as in genetic engineering, you can splice and change one gene and it alters the expression of the crop or animal, what we've done is alter essentially one sentence in the corporate code that over time will completely transform the collective intelligence and conscience of the corporation as it's expressed in society, because all of a sudden you shift from having a pecuniary conscience where all the corporation and its directors are concerned about is profit for shareholders.
Because that's what they're compelled to be concerned about.
To a planetary conscience and consciousness where they're not only optimizing profit for shareholders, but they're also making sure that the corporation provides a material positive impact on society and the environment.
Yeah, it's delightful in its elegance. And what I really like about the work you're doing, John, and the way you talk about it is it's very thoroughly thought through, right? You're taking into consideration the neurology, the social fabric, and the legal framework so that we can find a path of minimal disturbance, triggering of the fight or flight response and yet still create a cascade of positive consequence.
Exactly. You know, change is painful for humans and it's very, very stressful. And what I've learned in this process is that you have to make it really, really easy for people to change. And more importantly, you have to empower them to make the choice themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, I learned the hard way that as attached as my ego may have gotten to benefit corporation legislation and some of the ideas in my book, I had to surrender my attachment to the outcome and really let go and serve the truth rather than my own ego, and really make it, try to present ideas in a way that allows people to see what the obvious choice is for themselves and make it voluntarily and intelligently on their own without anybody trying to force them to change.
Yeah, the desire to subtly coerce kind of needs to be dropped, doesn't it?
It really does, or you end up where I often found myself with a great big lump on my forehead from trying to beat my head against a door.
Well, it's good to know this, that I'm not the only one out there. Well, so what makes the benefit corporation a better investment?
Well, What's interesting is that human beings generally like to support life, and we generally support each other and our entities that are the most life supporting.
Hmm.
So some of the early literature on this subject are books like Profit for Life and Firms of Endearment, and a white paper by Professor Eccles at Harvard Business School, which shows that companies that adopt principles of sustainability significantly outperform the economics of the economic return of their conventional peers. So the good news is, you know, people think that being socially responsible and being cognizant of the consequences of corporate behavior on society and the environment is more expensive. But, you know, companies like Stony Brook Farms, I think, you know, an organic dairy product producer in the East Coast, found that, you know, yes, it was more expensive to pay farmers a premium for organic. But what they found was that their story, the company's story, was so compelling for consumers that they more than made up for the increased product costs by the fact that they really didn't have to spend any money on advertising
and
marketing.
Right, right.
You know, and I think Whole Foods is a pretty good example of a business that, you know, is really trying hard to do the right thing. And, you know, they're not, it hasn't been perfect, but John Mackey, the leader and founder of Whole Foods, has done a pretty good job promoting his company as an exemplar of, you know, a new style of business, you know, called conscious capitalism, in which the CEO is a steward for the corporation and its ecosystem of stakeholders. You know, the corporation is not just a duopoly of management and stockholders, but a system of multiple stakeholders, including employees and vendors and so on and so forth. You know, the corporation has a conscious culture that's values-based, and the company has a heroic purpose that transcends and includes the Milton Friedman version that the corporation exists solely to maximize profit for shareholders, period, you know, end of story.
Mm. Right. So it's interesting because I think I've been wondering about when this shift would occur, and maybe we are actually at the tipping point where the idea that doing something in an unsustainable way that highly externalizes and puts burden on the commons for all this other stuff, for all the costs and the, you know, all the cleanup and the reintegration of waste and all that kind of stuff, actually at some point becomes less efficient than doing things in a sustainable way. Creating all that waste, whether you have to pay for it or not, starts to rub up against the constraints of a closed system such that you cannot do that as effectively anymore. And it really becomes easier to do the sustainable thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are getting to a tipping point. And the reality is that we're at the very front end of figuring out new ways of measuring how we do business that actually started beginning to quantify the environmental and social impacts of corporate behavior. So, you know, as far as the, you know, the tipping point is concerned, I think we're getting close. The other thing that to keep in mind is that, you know, I like to think of the internet as the collective consciousness of the emerging collective consciousness of humanity.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're wired together. We're in a system that allows information to travel at the speed of light in a way that and connect us in a way that we've never been connected before. And you know, if you think of the Eastern chakra system with seven chakras, the first being survival, that's Google. How do we get the information we need to survive in the internet age? Second chakra is, you know, emotions and sexuality, and that's Facebook, which got hired by a smart Harvard undergrad who wanted to figure out how to get laid. So that manages your relationships. And then you've got the third chakra, which is about power and status. That's LinkedIn. That manages your career and your resume. But what's really exciting is that we're starting to get some higher chakra companies emerge. I look at Avaaz, which has 20 million members worldwide, and Credo as emerging as the collective conscience of humanity. And what's really cool is that we're starting to, you know, conscience is so showing up in the internet. And where we're going is that things are becoming so transparent that we're going to be able to tell immediately which company is engaging in sustainable practices or which company is more sustainable and more environmentally friendly or socially responsible than the next one. And consumers are increasingly voting with their pocketbook and choosing the more socially responsible or more environmentally sustainable provider, such as a Whole Foods, even if it's more expensive, just because they feel like they're contributing towards the evolution, our evolution to a more sustainable global economic system.
Yeah, I think this is a really powerful thing that's happening. The ability of the people to recognize bad actors and the consequence of a bad, the consequences to a bad actor are, you know, they're collectivized now, right? We can send a petition around highlighting somebody's misbehavior and get 100,000 signatures or a million signatures. And that actually stimulates change. And I'm really excited about that.
It really does stimulate change, and it starts holding our collective social organisms accountable to society at large.
Yes, that's awesome.
And this is the missing piece. And what it will start doing is rewarding companies that are more socially responsible and environmentally sustainable over the long term than those that aren't.
Well, in direct proportion to our, to how much we value social responsibility, right?
Yes.
Because if we're still all asleep, then it really doesn't matter.
Right.
So I want to take a short break again here and then come back and talk a little bit about the emergence of consciousness, the awakening process and what we might be seeing and what you're experiencing out there in the world. So short break, and we'll be right back.
A personal tarot reading can offer you insight, information, enlightenment, and empowerment along your life's path. Hi C is a professional tarot conversationalist and ritualist with over 10 years' experience. He's available for readings in a variety of formats, including parties and events. To schedule your personal tarot reading, contact Hi-C at tarotbyhi-c.net or email him at hic@fireflywillows.com.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm John Carosella here with John Montgomery for today's Spirited Conversation. John, before the break, we were talking about the social feedback mechanism that's emerging through the internet to hold our collective organisms, our social constructs, accountable to us. And, you know, it really does depend on us as individuals to be part of that feedback loop. How is it that we are, I mean, this is a big question, so, you know, feel free to pass on it, but how is it that we are waking up? How are we waking ourselves up? What's happening that's allowing us to be more aware of ourselves as conscious beings that can hold our corporations and institutions accountable?
Well, I think we have an unprecedented access to information. I mean, you go online and you know, in a few nanoseconds, you can get information about any subject that you could possibly ever be interested in. You know, education is going online. You know, we're gaining access to wisdom that you know, previously it was only available in relatively esoteric circles. So there's a great democratization of access to information. And part of why we're waking up is that there's a lot of stress in the system.
Ah, right.
That is causing friction, and it's pretty hard not to notice that the climate is changing and that you know, weather is becoming more severe, and that our economic troubles get more radical and nearly, you know, like the 2008 financial crisis that nearly brought down the entire global economic system. So, you know, I think there's a lot of stress in the system, and that's causing people to really, you know, look inside. And I think this is really the next frontier. You know, in the integral theory model, there's the collective exterior and the collective interior. There's the individual interior and the individual exterior. And on both the individual and collective exterior, it's all about doing. And I think what we're realizing is that each of us has an inner world and a whole complex set of inner processes. You know, our brain and nervous system doesn't come with an operating manual. And in order to function in this rapidly evolving interdependent global economic system, we have to figure out how to find the control panel of our brain and nervous system so that we can operate effectively and not get not be in reactivity all the time.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, we had talked about this once upon a time as we have developed a million hardware, but we're still running reptilian software.
Exactly.
And we have really powerful hardware now, but we're running the wrong program.
Well, and we've always had really powerful hardware, and I keep bringing up IBM. You know, they have a research project in their global operations to emulate what the human brain does. And I went to a presentation at the Almaden Research Center a couple of years ago by the guy that's running this project, and he basically said that in order for computers to replicate what our brain does in 1 second with approximately 25 watts of power would require, I think, about 30 billion watts of power and 500 of the world's largest supercomputers hardwired together to begin to emulate what our brains do every second. And part of the new frontier for mankind is to really start going within and figuring out how to optimize our ability to access our enormous capacity of intelligence, consciousness, and love, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so you've been on a very interesting journey yourself. I mean, you talked a little bit in the beginning about your fine arts background and the creative aspect of crafting companies. And I can see and understand how that is a very fundamental harmonic in how you operate in the world. But there's more to you than that. You've done some pretty significant stuff since the internet boom and all that, the heyday of all that busyness. What's it been like for you?
Well, I had one of those epiphanies that are life-changing in 2002 when one of my partners from Brobeck insisted that I read Jim Collins' Good to Great. And in the middle of reading that book, I had an epiphany that just as Collins had seen good companies make the transition from good to great and it uncovered a common pattern in those great companies, I realized that I had a nucleus of enormously successful startups in the 1990s that were co-founded by a particular venture capitalist who served as the co-founding executive chairman, and that there was a common pattern in these enormously successful companies. And I figured that if I could reverse engineer that pattern, I would have a scalable, repeatable process that wouldn't guarantee a company's success, but it would optimize the probability of success. So in 2003, I started a law firm with the naive assumption that I had figured out this methodology and that I could easily replicate it by attracting a particular quality and caliber of entrepreneur and recreate the success of my mentor's incubator.
Uh-huh.
And what happened was 3 years into the journey, I looked around the law firm and I went, oh, crap. I have successfully recreated all of the unresolved issues from my family of origin.
Well done.
And it was really quite disheartening to look around and go, crap, I'm the founder of this place. I'm the fearless leader. And I'm seeing dysfunction that reminds me very much of, you know, the family that I grew up in.
Yeah.
And in particular, I got very good at avoiding conflict when I was a boy and young man. And, you know, my aversion to conflict had very negative consequences in the business that I created, among other, you know, that was probably the most glaring, you know, of my flaws that showed up in the collective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that led me to, you know, a very deep inner journey. I was already on a, you know, a spiritual path, but that really woke me up to the fact that I had a lot of work to do. And, you know, I looked around and some of the best technology for taming the mind and learning how to tame one's thoughts and emotions is in the Himalayan Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And I went deep into that system and learned their techniques for taming the mind. And I also did an intensive executive coaching program to get a, you know, a 360 view of my personality, and did a bunch of other work that really helped me wake up and start seeing, really learning how to bring more consciousness into how I approach life.
And what happened? What was the result?
Well, I mean, amazing things have happened. I've generally learned how not to be victimized by my emotions, and have learned how to find a relatively stable place internally that is behind thoughts and emotions. You know, the Tibetans like to help you find the sky-like nature of your mind, and in their metaphor, thoughts and emotions are like clouds that scud across your mind or your consciousness. And we in the West tend to over-identify with our thoughts and emotions and think that they are who we are. And developing, you know, as Bob Keegan at Harvard calls it, the subject-object move, where you can make object your thoughts and emotions so you're no longer subject to them, is really, really important. And I think this is going to become one of the core skills of leadership, is empowering leaders to make that move so that they can remain, you know, engaged but detached simultaneously. And when you can make that move, you can respond intelligently to whatever crisis has shown up in your inbox, rather than react subconsciously or habitually to it.
Yeah.
And that's the really big shift, one of the big shifts that's coming in the business world.
Making it not about you, right?
Making it not about you.
Yeah. It's a, you know, serving the vision, serving the mission. And if it's a conscious corporation, you can do that with some joy and delight, right? As opposed to just self-interest.
Well, absolutely. And a conscious corporation actually becomes a personal growth engine, because it's with the right leadership and the right environment, it becomes an absolutely fabulous vehicle for personal growth.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, we're just about out of time. Is there any last thoughts or notions that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'd like to just give your audience a bit of hope. What I've discovered is, you know, I'm 55 years old, and, you know, I've practiced in Silicon Valley since 1984. A lot of my peers are resistant to benefit corporation principles and conscious capitalism principles. But what I'm finding is that my children and their peers, the young entrepreneurs that are coming up in their 20s and 30s, they're already thinking this way.
Right.
And my belief is that these young entrepreneurs, they're already natives in the new paradigm where corporations exist to optimize good and profit. And these young entrepreneurs are the future leaders of the global economic system. And my belief is that with new vehicles like benefit corporation legislation, movements like conscious capitalism and its principles, and these young leaders, we're going to be able to transform the economic system from one that runs on fear and greed, which mimics, you know, the brain and nervous system, which is 90% fight or flight and 5% reward, to one that actually begins to become trustworthy and stable, that runs on love and trust. And the, you know, the neuroscience shows that when we humans are in that kind of a working environment, we're twice as productive, and our brains produce oxytocin and dopamine, which make us feel happy and bonded with our coworkers. And that's the world that is coming. And I am very encouraged, because I think we are getting to a tipping point, and the next generation of entrepreneurs is going to help the planet get there faster than those of us in power can even begin to imagine.
Well, that is a hopeful sentiment, and I'm right there with you. I think it's fantastic. So if folks want to get to know you and or your work a little bit better, where might we direct them?
Well, there's a website for my book, Great from the Start, where you can download the introduction, preface, and epilogue for free. If you're inspired, please post a review of the book on Amazon. You can also check out my profile on LinkedIn, where I have posted links to videos and various papers that I have published on the subject of benefit corporations and other topics.
That's awesome. So, John, thank you very much for joining us. The gist of what I wanted to bring out in this conversation with you is that there is a way to do it differently, and that there are people like you who are making it happen. So thanks very much for joining us.
You're most welcome, John. Thanks for having me on the program.
Life comes at you pretty fast, and you're doing the best you can. But maybe you could use a little help. Are you looking for answers or feeling a little stuck? Something nagging you that you and your doctor can't quite explain? Or maybe you're looking to enhance your game or improve your performance at work? Consider a visit with John Carosella at The Shamanist. Whether you need a little guidance or even a little miracle, John can help. Visit in person or connect by phone or Skype. Schedule a rune, oracle, or tarot reading. Experience a shamanic counseling session. or a Reju Keto or shamanic healing session for body and soul. Experience more of your world and yourself. The sky's the limit when you tap into the realities that are just beyond our sight. Mention this ad and receive a special gift when you book your first session with John. For a little help, or maybe a little miracle, theshamanist.com.
Welcome back. This is Convergence. I'm your host, John Carosella. Now, I'm a self-professed gardener, and lately, that's been taking on a broader and more subtle meaning for me. So, in today's reflection segment, I thought I'd share with you my perspective on what it means to be a gardener and to live in a garden. I was a product manager in high tech for years. Product management in high tech is one of those incredibly challenging positions where things move fast under your feet, technology shifts, customers' needs change, the market moves in radical directions based on a new discovery, and all the while, you're constrained by resources, trying to build a product that somebody will want. But you won't find out if you're right, really, for about 3 years. From the time you envision the product to the time you actually figure out whether the market is receiving it well, it's 3 years. 3 years is a long time to wait to get feedback on your decisions. And in high tech, that's an eternity. There's only one job that I've been exposed to that's harder, and that's being a parent. The cycle time on whether you've done a good job is about 20 years. And your ability to make mid-course corrections starts to shrink about 7 years into the exercise and plummets to just about zero after seven more. Yep, for me, it's the ultimate test of a gardener's ability to cultivate. Now, we live in a garden. This planet is a garden. We have so many ways in which we express that fundamental truth. You get what you pay for. You get out of it what you put into it. You reap what you sow. You are what you eat. Garbage in, garbage out. There are many more. All these phrases point to a fundamental characteristic of the human universe. We are gardeners, and we are also not separate from the garden. It's one of those things that makes humans special. Last month, I shared my musings that everything is the best in the world at something, and that humans are the best in the world at creating change. It's another way of highlighting that we are mighty powerful gardeners in this garden that we call Earth. And it's not just restricted to the Earth, the planet. We're also gardeners in the noosphere, that ephemeral land of ideas and influences and knowledge and experience. We are shapers, pruners, sowers, and reapers there, too. One of the most powerful realizations I've had over the years is just how much influence I have over my most intimate garden, myself. I've shared in the past that adversity is the universe's way of illuminating aspects of our character that we wouldn't discover any other way. It's nature's blind spot illuminator. If only we could let go of our ego and see adversity as a torch, not a torture, a personal gift, not a personal punishment. So why do bad things happen to good people? I don't know. I think we have three choices, though. The first is that somebody, God, the devil, or just a sloppy transgalactic engineering team, is responsible. They're out to get us, or they just suck at doing their job. The second is that there is no sense to it all, which calls into question the sensibility of the whole system. And the third is that there's some meaning behind it, and that there's an opportunity. For those among us who believe in reincarnation and soul contracts and so on, the third option seems sensible, even if we have to struggle to embrace it. But let's for a moment consider the second scenario. Even if there's no sense, no meaning, no plan to all this chaotic and potentially dangerous living process we've fallen into, what then? I mean, we're hurtling through space at anywhere between 44,000 and 550,000 miles per hour, depending on your reference point, with absolutely no control of the vehicle, what could possibly go wrong? Well, okay, let's say there's no plan. There's only experience. Here we are, hurtling uncontrollably through space, having a human experience. And we experience something that we don't like. What do we do with that? We can absorb it and move on. We can deny it, rail against it as unjust, and pretend that isn't how it is, and engage in dysfunction. Disconnecting from reality makes it harder to be functional. Or we can harvest something from it. But how? Well, for me, the most important essential first step is not to take it personally, which should be easy at this point since we've embraced the idea that we're on a stage with no stage directions, no plot, no omniscient narrator. So nothing is personal. Even people who are acting, let's say, malevolently, are not doing anything personal to you. They're just acting out their own story with you as an incidental prop. And that, by the way, means that you are just acting out your own story with everything and everyone around you as an incidental prop. Pretty weird, huh? It devolves quickly into Descartes' cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. But beyond that, we can't be sure of anything. I suspect a more accurate way of saying this is that I recognize that I have experiences, therefore I am. So let's get back to having an experience. Here I am having an experience of adversity. It's not personal. I'm being buffeted by the storm of all of our collective experiences. What do I do about it? I can't blame anybody because none of it is personal. I can't necessarily stop it from happening. Oftentimes the forces that come together are overwhelming, or an experience happens quickly and delivers seemingly permanent consequences. So what's left? Here's where I begin to look for the blind spot. Here's where adversity becomes the teacher and the torch. Everything that happens to me happens to something, some version or aspect of me. That aspect of me is experiencing the world from a very specific perspective. That perspective is hugely determined by my conditioning and my value system. Bearing that in mind, now the good doctor inside me compels me to ask the question, where does it hurt? Where indeed? Over the years, I've gotten better and better at asking and answering this question. Where does it hurt? The first place to look is the ego. So much of our suffering comes from pain the ego experiences. Interestingly, the ego is typically a proud, protective, silly, and somewhat immature being that has not learned very much that's absolutely true, but what it has learned, it clings to as absolute truth. That's our conditioning. How deep does that conditioning go? Really deep. Ask anyone who has healed a real, actual physical trauma through the power of the breath. The entire process is one of identifying where it hurts, recognizing that the pain is just the tip of the story, and going deeper and deeper into the experience. Fundamental to this process is an acknowledgement, and often the discovery, that we're much more flexible, mutable, and plastic than we've been led to believe. Done expertly, where does it hurt becomes a deep dive into the subtle aspects of our nature. And our bodies are just one aspect of ourselves. The body is, relatively, slow to adjust to realizations and shifts in our consciousness, and our bones and nerves are perhaps the slowest parts within our bodies. But they do adjust. The body can and does re-resonate with shifts in our awareness. I've been doing some very deep cleaning of some very old wounds. At least it seems deep to me compared with my old way of experiencing. Through the combination of body awareness and attentiveness to my breath, I've found pockets of old stuff, a a kind of psychic gunk stuck in parts of my body that have been identified, tended to, and transformed. I've been taking out the psychic trash quite regularly over the past couple of years, and the process has been accelerating lately. This trash is both mental and physical. My triggers are shifting. They're harder to set off, and there seem to be fewer of them. I'm also much more grounded in the reality of my circumstances. I delude myself much less about myself and my surroundings, and as a result, I'm counting my blessings and forgiving myself much more. And what's even better is that I'm not as stuck in repeating patterns. Sure, they're still there, but when I'm on my game, I can see them for what they are. That I'm semi-consciously sowing the seeds of my own harvest of adversity. I'm subtly crafting the circumstances for the teacher, the torch of adversity, to appear. Some aspects of myself I am not yet able to discover and deal with any other way. Heather Ashamaro, who joined me here on Convergence last December, shared some Toltec wisdom that I embrace almost every day. She said, "You can't get to where you want to go if you are unable or unwilling to recognize where you currently are. If you try to make changes from a place where you wish you were instead of where you actually are, you're not going to make very good progress. The process of true change must start with a recognition of your current condition. What is the nature of the soil you're standing in? How much sunlight are you actually getting? Are you blooming? Are you bearing fruit? Do you need water, rest, pruning, a good bath and insecticidal soap, perhaps?" The key here is that proper self-observation cannot occur without examining your whole self. And where you're experiencing adversity, where you're experiencing pain, is part of your whole self. And where you're experiencing pain, there are really two choices. You can examine it, or you can hide from it. If you hide from it or numb it, you won't learn anything about it. If you examine it, you have to go into it and feel it. It's the total opposite of our conditioning. If you examine it, you have to go into it and feel it. It's the total opposite of our conditioning. Pain equals bad, says our conditioning. But pain is just pain. I'm fond of saying that there are two kinds of pain. Pain where healing is occurring, and pain where healing is not occurring. I know which kind I'd rather feel. But wait, can't we just choose to not feel pain? Well, some of us can, kind of. Most of us try. A large swath of our behavior, genetic, inherited, and cultural, stems from the desire to avoid pain. We can try to insulate ourselves from the experiences of life, but then we're insulating ourselves from the experiences of life. How satisfying is that going to be? And how much will we grow? What kind of harvest will we find? And honestly, it's too late to insulate yourself, because if you're older than 5, you've already had a bucketful of experiences that have conditioned you to a particular and largely inaccurate view of the world, which means everything you're experiencing is happening through that weird, distorted lens of your parents, your culture, and your personal experience. So even your choices regarding how to insulate yourself and what to insulate yourself from are bound to be just as ineffective as your lens is inaccurate. We reap what we sow. That means we get out of it what we put into it. We experience the world as a reflection of our own expression into the world. How is that possible, you may ask? Isn't the world full of mechanisms set in motion by others? Aren't we at the mercy of all that? What possible impact can my own insignificant, under-resourced efforts have on this grand juggernaut? Well, I think it's maybe a mistake to try to answer these questions before discovering all of who you really are. it can be misleading to try to evaluate your hand in all this when parts of yourself are being applied unconsciously to the cultivation of who knows what in your particular corner of the garden. Chances are you're not applying all of yourself consciously to the unwinding of problems of your experience. In fact, chances are quite good that you're actually subconsciously crafting adversity unconsciously so that you can discover aspects of yourself that you wouldn't be able to see any other way, and as a result, become more conscious of who you really are. From the perspective of a diminished self, having an impact on the universe you experience may seem impossible. It defies common sense. But then, so does moving towards pain. This whole place is a garden, and we are both a part of the garden and one of the gardeners. We get to choose just how consciously we garden, and it starts with a careful and willing examination of the complete self, including the unsavory, unseemly, and painful parts, and the adversity that illuminates them. And isn't that the loving thing to do anyway? What gardener would expect a harvest from his garden without tending to it, nurturing it, cultivating it? And what harvest would he find? Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the program. I hope you're enjoying the fantastic, beautiful, vibrant experience of May. I hope you're, in some way at least, getting something out of that pollen. And as you're out and about, engaging with and working for those social institutions that are all around us, those living organisms that we are the creators of, think about being a gardener there too. We reap what we sow. We can make a difference. Thanks again. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for A Shamanic Life with John Caracella, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.